Okay, so here we are. The four immeasurables, let's just remind ourselves of them. I'll just read them out, the shorter version of them that we've had, just again to help set our motivation for this morning's activities. Oh, brilliant. Thank you, Steph. Screen sharing. There we go. Marvels of technology when it works. Feel free to join in or to think them to yourself if you wish, or just listen, that's fine. And I'll take a little pause at the end of each one. So, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And we spoke about happiness, what it might mean, and what the causes might be yesterday. And that wish is the wish of immeasurable love, all sentient beings being the key there, excluding none. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. A heartfelt aspiration that I'm sure we all feel whenever we watch the news or read the papers or even within our own lives and lives of those we care about, we see suffering. It's a natural human wish that sentient beings be free from suffering. Once you start an inner journey, you begin to think about the real causes of suffering or the underlying causes of suffering. So this then is the basis of compassion, which we'll talk about this morning. And again, it becomes immeasurable compassion. When it becomes so deep that it's part of our absolute nature, it's part of the air that we breathe in and out, in fact, and also again excludes no one. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. So just as when, as a parent, we see our children happy and flourishing and doing well, we hope that they're never separated from that, that that never ceases. And in the Buddhist context, that means if beings are free from the causes of suffering and have the causes of happiness, then they can reach that stage, as I said earlier, where there is no chance of suffering ever arising again. They abide totally in happiness. And that's immeasurable joy. There's a lot more to unpick there, so we'll look at that this afternoon. And then the sort of the underlying basis of these previous three is the next one. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, unaffected by attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, we talked about that yesterday. Knowing that, natural is part of a natural part of being alive is that whatever we come into contact with, there will arise feelings in relation to that, feelings of being drawn towards something, of attachment, feelings of not wanting it in our lives or them in our lives, and that's aversion. And these both, are born of a misunderstanding of how we exist and how we exist in relation to everyone and everything else. And if we are to extend our love and our compassion and our rejoicing, our joy, to all without exception, then of course we need to kind of unpick those preconceptions, those judgments. Even the perceptions that we have, to be able to recognize, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, our common humanity, that just like me, here is a suffering sentient being who wants to be happy, and doesn't want suffering. And just like me, they sometimes make mistakes. They undoubtedly make mistakes. So can I relate to the person behind the behavior in whichever way it goes? So I guess that counts as a brief recap as well. Thanks. I don't know if you thank. Thanks. Yeah. A brief recap of what we did yesterday. We talked also about, we referred to our true nature, and those of us who are here, well, we, I'm saying, sort of shared a common belief that actually, you know, basic fundamental human nature is positive, loving, is a Buddha nature, what's often called Buddha potential. Somebody will get that, I'm sure. Yeah. So as opposed to what is a fairly common view that actually our good qualities, our, you know, civilization is only skin deep, that our good qualities are only a veneer over our basic animal instincts. And that's not a view that within Buddhism we subscribe to at all. It's a much more optimistic view that we have, that we all have this incredible potential. We know that we have the basis of love, compassion, joy, and impartiality or balance within us. And what we're doing is we're working to increase those, basically, to learn to see clearly, and then to be able to respond with compassion. And we recognize that the cultivation of these positive qualities, love, compassion, joy, and balance or equanimity, they represent a gradual process. Either you can kind of look at it either as a gradual process of building up our kind of, you know, mental muscle to be able to do this. Thanks very much. So that's one say. So we are, you know, we are increasing the qualities that we have, and we're working specifically to do that, to become more familiar with them, is what we were saying yesterday, through meditation, through life experiences, to become more familiar with positive qualities, that that they then become a divine abode. They then become the way that we are, the way that we spontaneously think and feel and act within the world. Another way of looking at it, and both ways have value, and both ways kind of interact quite nicely, is that we have this incredible potential within us already, but through these misunderstandings and past habits that we have, this basic good quality, these basic good qualities are shrouded, are covered, and so we're sort of removing the barriers to their expression. So both ways equally have value, and at different times we might want to try different approaches. So there we go. Let's start with. First of all, also, I wanted to apologise. I've already apologised to you, Leilani, but Sally, I thought that the resources sheets that I'd created were already available and online, but it seems like they're not. So, Sally, if you do want me to send them to you, if you can give your email address to Steph later, then I can email them to you. It's two sheets, okay?
Yeah, I will do. Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. And apologies from Claire. She can't make it today, so it's even cozier, even cozier today. Never mind, that's fine. Quality as opposed to quantity. So compassion. So let's start with the definition. The definition that we're going to work with is the wish, as within the prayer that we said at the beginning, that all beings everywhere be free from suffering and its causes, regardless of our relationship to them. And actually, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has a wonderful quote as ever on it. He says, true compassion is not just an emotional response. So as we were saying yesterday when we were talking about meditation, there is an element of emotion within there, but it's not just that. It's a firm commitment founded on reason. So we think, as we did yesterday in terms of love, we think about all the benefits of compassion. We think about the disadvantages of not increasing that in ourselves. And we recognize that actually, based on a correct understanding of our interconnectedness on this small blue planet, it is the only reasonable way to go forward. It's, as we said yesterday, regards love, it's a no-brainer. That's what, of course, we do. If we want to be happy in ourselves and physically and mentally healthy in ourselves, and if we want to contribute to a happy and physically and mentally healthy planet and its inhabitants. Anyway, so back to His Holiness. True compassion is not just an emotional response, but a firm commitment founded on reason. Therefore, a truly compassionate attitude towards others doesn't change even if they behave negatively. And so, again, we touched on this yesterday. There is so much, they interweave so much that I'll repeat myself a lot, but I think it's worth doing. But what we are aiming to do is to separate out, make sure that we keep separating our minds if we see somebody behaving harmfully in a way that we don't agree with or don't like, or is clearly harmful to themselves or others and or others, then we can separate out the person and their behavior. And we keep them separate. So we can deal with, we can respond appropriately to the behavior, which we may well want to point out is inappropriate, is harmful, and is unacceptable. But we can still, again, keep the person separate. We can still have a fundamental respect for this other human being, recognizing their confusion. And actually, I'm sure even, people who are very skilled in mediation and things like that in worldly activities know this to be true. It's a fact. I have a friend who used to be a policeman, and it was the same. Their training was exactly the same, that you separate out. And as teachers, actually, we in schools were trained to separate out the behavior from the person. But that's not what we tend to do generally. We tend to see somebody behaving in a way that's negative, and we think bad person. And then we're stuck because we think that, with that judgment comes all sorts of other kind of baggage they're a bad person. That is intrinsically who they are. Even if I were to witness them doing something positive, either I probably wouldn't notice, or because perception is a two-way process. It's not just me receiving, as we said yesterday. It's an active process. I actively participate in perceiving. We do that all the time. We filter out things that are not relevant, or else we go mad, basically. I think we wouldn't be able to function. So we filter a lot out. And so, the actual even perception is not neutral. We are active participants in that. So whatever we believe flavors, colors what we see. So there's that, and there was something else, but I got sidetracked and I've forgotten it. So this is what we see. But even if we do notice it and observe it and register it, a person we've defined as a bad person, and for me this works, I can see this very clearly in the lives of politicians that I don't like, then even if they do something which is positive, there is this thing of, well, they would say that anyway. Oh yeah, really expect me to believe that? There's cynicism can take over, basically, and we don't accept it, we don't believe it, because we've made that basic mistake of conflating the person and their behavior. So it doesn't get anywhere. Again, if you think of trying to solve problems, even in our own life, if we are, sort of working, trying to solve a disagreement with somebody or trying to help somebody, others solve a disagreement, if their positions are fixed, then often within an argument or a disagreement, positions become even more fixed and entrenched, then, there's no chance. So it, again, another no-brainer. Anyway, so I've lost all track of time at the moment, so but I'll keep on. So that's the definition. And again, as we said yesterday, it's kind of the flip side of love. The two obviously go together. It's just we're focusing on one particular aspect. We're focusing on the person's happiness and their own happiness in the first, in the case of love, and we're focusing on the suffering and hopefully for the removal of suffering in the case of compassion. But you can't really have one without the other. It's an aspiration, as we said, and it's something that we work on. We practice, literally, we practice bringing up compassion in our lives, on the meditation cushion, and, you know, in our daily life as well. Then we talked about, in the prayer, it talks about suffering and its causes. And again, similar to loving kindness and happiness and its causes, within the Buddhist view, although we often attach blame to our problems and difficulties to someone or something or some situation out there, by and large, within Buddhism, those are just stimuli or triggers or conditions to the mental state of suffering. But suffering is a mental state, so the causes are mental. So it's within our own minds that we can work to overcome suffering, so which is by not creating the causes. Is that clear? I'm not sure if I've made that clear. Is that okay? Yeah, thank you. Okay. And actually, the causes are quite clear. It's harmful or toxic states of mind, and we know what they are. You know, anger, greed, jealousy, for example. They're painful as and when they happen, and they are causes for future suffering for ourselves as well as others. Like I said yesterday, the image of the throwing a hot coal at somebody, we suffer most after that. So this view actually, as I said, is very liberating, you know, based on this view that we do have this incredible positive potential. We're not, there's no original sin or anything like that. We are not, we are basically good. Yeah, fundamentally, we are good and loving and kind. And you know, if we use and learn and use the techniques, then we have incredible agency. We are, as Venerable Rabina, the nun I love to quote, you know, we're the boss. We can change. We have, you know, the situations that we find ourselves in. Yes, some of them may be extremely difficult, and I don't want to underplay or, you know, sort of dismiss anybody's lived experience, and who knows what is coming in the future for us. But we do have a choice, and that is fundamentally liberating. We have a choice how we respond. In the moment, it may be that we are overwhelmed by situations, but if we practice and if we, you know, if we work while we can to make our home in these positive states of mind, then our responses will be different, will be more skillful, and will be tend towards happiness, joy, and the end of suffering. So,
say that is, excuse me interrupting, but
yeah, no, please do, actually, that's good.
Brilliant to say that we can make our home in those states of mind. That's whoa, great, you know, that's a wonderful concept. Thank you for that.
Yes, well, it's not mine, of course, but it's but yeah, thank you. And thank you actually for you know, given that we're such a small group, please do, Sally or Lilani or Steph, if you're not too busy, feel free to join in, you know, and question and comment, because, you know, it's more like a conversation, really, isn't it? Except that I'm talking all the time. But join in, please, feel free if you want. That's great. Thank you. Yeah, and exactly that's it. Let's make our home in these positive states. And actually, it was only as I was thinking about it on Friday evening, I think, that concept, although I've used the words a lot, really came alive for me when I realized, you know, there is the alternative, making our home in anxiety, in, you know, depression or in, you know, in those other, there's, you know, resentment, you know, why would anyone, you know, if once you see the choice, once it's been pointed out, you make clear, you think, again, you know, to overuse the phrase, no brainer. Why would we, you know, really? So, yeah, that's good to remember. Thank you. Thanks, Leilani.
Brilliant.
So, compassion is difficult. There's, you know, it is a natural response, but it, you know, it's not trouble-free, I guess, in a sense. It takes courage, I think, because what we're asked to do is really be open to suffering and not take and problems and difficulties, and not, you know, our own and other people, and not kind of fall into the usual kind of escape mechanisms of turning away, closing down, distracting ourselves, and also not falling into the trap of becoming so overwhelmed we can't move. And I think partly what I've learned from this and the previous course I did purely on compassion is that it's a matter of translation, or it's not helped by translation. I looked up the Oxford English Dictionary, the definition of compassion, and it's the definition is to participate in another's suffering. And you can see that comes from the Latin root com, meaning with, passio, to suffer or to feel with. And with that definition, then it becomes almost inevitable. If somebody else is suffering and you participate in that suffering, if you resonate with them and suffer alongside them, you're going to burn out, especially if you're trying to expand that, your ability, your compassion, your ability to resonate and to respond. In Buddhism, there's a different definition. I'll read it to you. This comes from Thupten Jinpa's book on compassion called, it's on the book list, I can't remember what it's called, Something the Heart, a lovely, lovely book as well.
The Fearless Heart.
The Fearless Heart, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, what a great title as well, The Fearless Heart. This is what you need. Yeah. What we need to develop compassion. And he says, it's a sense of concern, so it is that we care, that arises when we are confronted with another's suffering, so we become aware of somebody else's suffering. Because often, you know, sometimes we can just go marching straight through and not even notice that somebody else is in pain. So it's a sense of concern. We care when we're confronted with another's suffering. And, you know, again, there's all sorts of neurological, you know, sort of signs of that, you know, sort of resonating with our brains, resonate with another person's suffering. The sense of concern, confronted with another suffering, and we feel motivated to see that suffering relieved. So that's the third aspect, I think, is additional to what, you know, our common English understanding of the word. The sense of concern when we see another person suffering, almost that could be like to participate in another's suffering. That's a natural response, physiological response as much as anything else. Within Buddhism, they take it this step further, which is and feel motivated to see that suffering relieved. I recognize your pain or my pain. I don't want it. I care. I empathize. And I want to remove it. Can I help? Those are the three aspects of it. And with that extra element, then maybe altruism is a better translation of the Buddhist understanding of compassion, of what we do call compassion. So we notice, we care, and we feel motivated to do something. Now, it may lead to action. We may be able to, you know, sort of pick somebody up, dust them off, give them a cup of tea or whatever. It may be sort of direct action like that. Maybe we take political action. It may be that we donate or give something to somebody who needs it. It may be that none of those are possible, you know, given our particular circumstances. But what we can do, even if we can't do anything practical or immediate like that, what we can do is to come back to this state of compassion in our heart and to renew our aspiration, our commitment to develop ourselves so that we are better able in the future to be able to help. And that is an action that we can take that moves us from that state of empathy, of feeling with, and actually makes us moves on. And that takes us away from that, the danger really of compassion fatigue that people talk about, people experience. I'm sure we've all been there as well, and we've been really, really working hard to try and help somebody or resolve a situation, really engaged, really with the person, and there comes a point when we just can't do it anymore and we burn out. Again, it's a skill that is learned and built up gradually. But this notion of I will do whatever I can, I may or may not, be able to do something immediately practical, helpful, but at the very least, and on top of probably the practical stuff, I will renew my commitment to develop myself as much as I can. That is doing something, definitely. It's not just doing nothing. And that moves us out of that sort of helplessness, and it's that gives us energy, the energy that compassion can give. So, for example, the current sort of ecological and climate crisis that we're in, people within who are active within XR, say, and other organisations that are working with these situations, what they say overwhelmingly, what they said to me is that actually moving from that grief and that despair that they may well be feeling into doing something, however that something may turn out, however small that something may be, actually brings great joy and great courage, and again with other doing with other people, a great sense of connectedness. It moves us beyond compassion fatigue. It moves beyond despair and overwhelm, depression. Yesterday, the structure of these. Are we okay there so far? Let's just stop there. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sally, you're okay with us? Yeah. I'm hoping. Yeah. You'll say if you're not. I'm bringing.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Yesterday we had the structure of a definition, and we talked about what it's not. So obviously the far enemy, the thing that it's the opposite of, and which it is a counterbalance to, again, is disdain or contempt or cruelty. When we see somebody suffering, we think, ha, you got yours, didn't you, kind of thing, I can't say I've never felt that or thought that, it happens, it arises, but compassion is the opposite of them. The near enemy, the thing that may look like it and may get confused for it, is often sort of pity or sentimentality. And I think the best way for me to understand the difference between the two is that pity or sentimentality is, it's kind of being awash with feelings, but not, it's still all about me and my feelings kind of thing. And pity is a kind of I'm up here and you're down there and I feel sorry for you, which, there are similarities, but it is essentially different. It's not equal, and it's not necessarily, it's not compassion according to the Buddhist definition. It's different. What else have we got? There's another really lovely quote from His Holiness about the courage that it gives. So he says, and this is, I think, very, very inspiring. He He says, a mind dedicated to compassion is like an overflowing reservoir. So that's the opposite of compassion fatigue, really. And I guess, you know, for me, again, as ever, his life, you know, the way he is, the energy that he puts into so much is a real, you know, living example of what's possible. So a mind dedicated to compassion is like an overflowing reservoir. It is a constant source of energy, determination, and goodness. You could compare compassion to a seed. If you cultivate it, it makes an abundance of other qualities blossom, such as forgiveness, tolerance, inner strength, and confidence, allowing us to conquer fear and anxiety. So there we go. That's what we can do if we want to be like. You ever see the film, a really old Disney cartoon, Jungle Book? Did anyone ever see that? And there's a song in there that Baloo the bear sings when to the little Mowgli, the little boy, because Baloo wants to become human. And it's woo-hoo-hoo, I want to be like you. And I often find myself humming that when I think about the Dalai Lama. I want to be like you. And we can. That's what he says. You know, it's not that he's come from some other planet or anything. He's just done the work in previous lives. We've done some to have got, done quite a lot to have gotten here and now to be, you know, to be studying these things and thinking about them and trying to integrate them into our lives as much as we can. Like Sally was saying yesterday, you know, every activity can be. But, you know, we can do it. That is our birthright. That's what we can do. So I don't know, maybe there is more that I can say, but maybe we could have a quick break now and then come back and I'll do a bit more saying, and then, you know, we can kind of open up the discussion, and then we'll do a meditation as well before 12. Is that okay with people? Okay. That's great. I was going to say one more thing. I know. Just one more little story. After you were talking yesterday about, you know, how you integrate your Tonglen into everything you do, I went into one of the outside toilets here. Mm-hmm. And there was a thing about a label, washing your hands. And actually there was a picture of Tyrannosaurus Rex. I don't know if you've seen it, Steph. It's really made me laugh. And it's, you know, the Tyrannosaurus Rex is the, you know, great big head, big muscular legs and body and that, and these tiny little arms. And it said, can't wash hands, extinct. And then underneath, it's got the four immeasurable prayer written out. And then it says, takes about 20 seconds, right? So, you know, washing our hands can become an exercise in the four immeasurable thoughts as well.
Yeah.
Nice.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Okay, thanks.